I'm Prosantha Chakrabarty. I'm a professor and curator of fishes at Louisiana State University. But this year I'm on sabbatical doing a Fulbright in Ottawa, Canada.
Cool. And explain Fulbright to me.
Yeah, Fulbright's a really cool program. I think it's 50 plus years old now. It allows young people who are looking to do an international exchange or up to professors like me who want to do a sabbatical in a different country. So it's an international program that allows Americans to go abroad and broaden their worldview, and also allows people to have some folks from the U.S. go and exchange ideas with.
And are you still working within your field there, or are you totally branching out for this year?
I'm still very much working in my field. The proposal I wrote was to do, instead of like deep time evolution stuff that I usually do, to do more sort of like what's going on right now in the world of fishes anyway. And so collecting things in the Ottawa River and elsewhere, just to figure out if building dams and having introduced species come in changes the populations so that we could study them long term, but more evolution and action stuff, but very much in line with my ichthyology background that I have. So, yeah.
When did you start the sabbatical?
It started last July. So okay. We'll be here almost a full year before we head back. A full pandemic year, whatever that is.
Right. Long dog year. It's been a refreshing, rejuvenating experience for you, I'm sure.
It has been. You know, I have two kids and a wife and two dogs. We had three dogs when we started. Now we have two dogs. And, just bringing the family and packing them up and going to a new city every once in a while is fun. We did that in D.C. in 2015, 2016. So, doing that every 4 or 5 years is a good experience to rejuvenate as a prof.
Yeah, for sure. So when you are back home in Baton Rouge, what do your roles there look like?
Yeah, so I sort of say I do 50% research, 50% teaching, and 50% curation. So that means I teach one semester a year, usually in the fall. So either teaching ichthyology, the study of fishes, or evolution. And sort of alternate between those two among some smaller classes if I have time. And then always doing research, trying to figure out, the tree of life and how fishes evolve and what that can tell us about evolutionary history or geological history. And, planning trips. We like to do 2-3 international trips a year to collect fishes, to study them abroad, usually in the Neotropics or Asia somewhere. But day to day, it's a lot of like almost everybody else, sitting in front of the computer, checking email, seeing what fires I can put out. But yeah, day to day is, checking that to-do list and see what's up,
Perfect. What drew you to science? What was your inspiration to start in this field?
Yeah, I love that question, because it's I like have like a flashback of like the moment, and it's sort of I grew up in New York City, and there wasn't a lot of wildlife per se to look at, and but I loved going to zoos and museums and watching like Marty Stauffer, Wild Kingdom kind of shows, and I don't know, they always, animals always got me interested in the world. And I mean, I remember distinctly being 5 or 6 and looking up at the dinosaurs at the American Museum and asking my dad, like, what is a person who studies, animals called? And he said, zoologist. I'm like, all right, that's what I'm going to be. there wasn't much more to it. And I'm sure like every kid has like, I want to be a fireman, policeman, or whatever, astronaut. And I just picked something I was able to, really find a passion for. And so for me, it was zoology. And I was lucky. I just found the right people to help me along that path.
Yeah. And when, to your point, growing up in New York City, it's kind of a a quick right angle, right? And to wanting to be, you know, studying fish and different things. So were your parents able to be supportive of that? Like when you said, "All right, this is where I want to go." Like what were your mentors along the way through the, you know, early school and high school and on?
Yeah. Very, you know, early on, for sure, my parents were very supportive. I mean, I was so young that they probably, you know, weren't going to push me towards engineering and becoming a doctor like lots of Indian kids' parents, I think, do, you know, like kind of famously. But my parents, they always were just kind of like, you know, do what you want, but just be really good at it. You know, don't half-ass it, just do it. And they didn't really understand, you know, what a person who studies zoology, what that means. You know, they knew the programs I liked and, you know, ordered me zoo books when I wanted it or whatever the kids' magazines were. But they were never pushing me towards one or the other. And, you know, beyond that, it was hard to find, you know, inspiration. I didn't know any scientists. My family was pretty right down the middle class, and I didn't meet any academics or scientists for a long time, you know, even past high school. But I did have some really good high school teachers that taught biology that kind of showed me the right path and the right path to, like, you know, what even how to become a scientist. So I didn't even know, you know, you need a PhD and all that stuff until much later.
It's one thing to figure out, hey, I like this, and it's the next big phase is like, all right, now how do I make that a career, right?
Yeah.
Like, sure, it's fun to study animals, but what do I do with them?
Yeah, I was like, am I going to be broke my whole life? Like, I don't know. I didn't know, you know, they don't dress particularly well, so it's not like, you know, like, what's a person who studies animals? What do you exactly study? How do you study it? All that stuff comes much later. And, you know, hopefully I like to help kids now to see, you know, what a scientist like me is like. Because, you know, you still don't meet, you know, most kinds of scientists. The people you see on TV are like, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, astrophysics, or like, you know, maybe Bill Nye or somebody like that. But there's a whole spectrum of us.
You know, obviously, as you said, you know, you had teachers and people explaining like what you needed, your PhD and all those things. How did you get from that point to where you are? Like, what were the steps where, you know, where did you get your PhD and what that experience? But then also, how did you zero in on your field of study now?
Yeah, that's great. I remember the big thing was working as a kid at like the Brooklyn Aquarium. And like, I was a volunteer, and I was like, I didn't really meet even then, you know, like the scientists behind the scenes. And I was like, I don't know what this is. And I just still like really liked animals. So I was like, I'm going to go to a school that has zoology. And my parents had taken me to Montreal, where I was actually born, but didn't live there very long. Because when I was one, my family moved to New York. And we went to Montreal and we saw this school, McGill, and it just looked like a castle. I don't think I remember seeing a university that was sort of separated from the rest of, you know, the city, like Queens College in New York or NYU. You know, it's like sort of, it's just, you know, buildings sort of haphazardly strewn around. But then, you know, you have to go through these gates to get to McGill. And I was like, oh, it'd be cool to come here. I think it was like maybe junior high or high school. Early high school, and they had a zoology program, and you know, I'd been saying I wanted to be a zoologist without really knowing what it meant. I was like, I should find a school that has it. So I went to McGill, got that zoology degree. A few chance encounters led me to do an undergrad research experience in the summer at the American Museum of Natural History, which is the Night at the Museum famous museum with the dinos plus lots of other stuff. And I worked with a wonderful person named Melanie Stiazny over that summer, who taught me all about fishes. And I, you know, loved her. She was just like incredibly charming and smart and knowledgeable, and described a new species with her. And she kind of put me in the club to like know and all the other cool ichthyologists, and sent me to a conference. I, after that, graduating from McGill, I went on to work for a year at the Bronx Zoo in the Bronx, ironically, and applied for grad schools. Got into the University of Michigan, where I did a PhD for 5 years, and that got me, you know, even deeper into the woods of ichthyology. Did a postdoc back at the American Museum in New York, so I spent 2 more years doing that, and got my gig at LSU in 2008. So I had a pretty straight path. You know, I really knew what I wanted to do early on, and sort of stuck with it, and had the, you know, the luck of having the right people sort of hold my hand through the hard parts where I didn't understand. And, you know, from then it was, you know, all about helping other people get up there too. But yeah, I had a pretty, you know, quick and narrow path, you know, didn't have to do like a master's in something I didn't want to do, or, you know, lots of undergrad projects and things not related to what I wanted to do. So I was pretty lucky.
Nice. What do you think, as you look back on where you are now and the stuff you've done in your career, like what are the highlights, some of the highlights for you at this point?
For me, it's, you know, I always think about being in the field. So just taking students out in the field, the people I've met in the field, you know, just like funny experiences with students. You know, I remember like my postdoc advisor, John Sparks, who I went to Singapore with, like he introduced me, like on the plane is like salivating. It's like, oh, we're going to Singapore. We're going to have roti canai. It's the most delicious like snack food. I'm like, how good can it be? You know, like he describes, it's like thin flaky bread and you dip it in curry. I'm like, oh, whatever. Yeah. And then I have it. It's like, oh my God, it's great. And then when I took my student, you know, like 10 years later, and I'm like on the plane, like, oh man, roti canai is so good. Singapore is the best food. I can't wait till you try it. And he's like, oh, what's the big deal? Then it's, you know, it's like a cycle. You know, things like that are the great, you know, you go from junior to senior really quick in academia. And for me, just the experiences of giving back to the students the same way that people gave back to me, you know, that's been really rewarding.
Awesome. Have there been, you know, we've talked to scientists kind of all over the spectrum, from engineers to, you know, scientists and researchers and different things. And one of the things that is such a common thread on all aspects is just like resilience. You know, whether it's an experiment or a test or a satellite or whatever it is, it doesn't maybe go the right way, or bumps along the way, or misdirects. It sounds like, you know, from what you said, you know, you kind of were lucky to have a pretty straight path to where you are now. But have there been bumps or hiccups along the way where you kind of had to overcome?
Yeah, some of them are like literal bumps and hiccups, you know, like, I mean, field work in the tropics is always a sketchy thing, you know, like there's venomous animals, there's times that we've been on boats where, you know, we thought we were gonna sink, you know, in the middle of the Amazon, and you're at some point, you're not thinking about yourself as much as like, oh my God, do I have to like call this person's parents? Like, do I have to like, you know, and the luck goes, it's not unlike having kids, or the worry anyway, you know, you don't treat your students like kids, but you worry about them and think about them, in a way that is like parental. And I think my epic failures, if I've had them, it's just like times where I've like confused, you know, like my life and like, you know, my worry for them or like, I'm thinking specifically, so I have twins, and I had twins at the same time I was teaching a new class, and my students were going all over the place, and I felt like I was like just totally losing control. You know, it's like, why is everybody going to Panama right now? Like, you know, I was trying to remember, think of having more control, especially as a new assistant professor. And I remember that just being like a total blur. I hardly remember anything, you know, one kid is one thing and two at the same time. You know, I think my epic failures were mostly in that year where I was just trying to figure out, you know, where to find my shoes and, you know, how to get out of bed. And then, you know, trying to control a lab that was pretty independent, which is great. And I think I learned from that, you know, failure of a year for me was that, you know, just let the students, they're smart people too. Just let them be them and let them figure things out. And they did, and it was wonderful transition for me, because I was like, oh, you know, I don't have to be as hands-on as I thought I needed to. I can learn from them a lot, and just let them be. And that was a big, big change for me.
They say it's better to have twins first. if you know what it's like to have a baby and then have twins, you're toast.
But yeah, you're toast, because you're like, oh, it's going to be easy.
Yeah.
And then two, you know, if you have two at the same time, the next year they're playmates. And then you don't have to be the one teaching them how to play chess and stuff. You let them figure it out.
What kind of, you know, you shared us the story about the flights to Singapore and whatnot. What other funny or memorable stories do you have from the field? I feel like, you know, one of my other questions is your favorite place to science, and it sounds like the field is it.
Oh, definitely the field. I mean, they're just funny stories. You know, you work really hard and you like try to like relax after, you know, you sit down, you've collected, and then you put the samples the way they need to be. And then, you know, you're tired and hot from a day of work, and you relax. And one of my favorites is, and you'll like this, Paul, I think we'd be good drinking buddies, by the way. In Tanzania, there was this like sort of shady bar, but it had like an epic drink every day. Like, you know, it's a place where you think you can get like, you know, the local beer maybe, and hope it's cold. But they always had like this really complicated cocktail, like the cocktail of the day. And I'd always get that no matter what it was. You know, it was always like, you know, agave cider with, you know, bubble tea, something, you know, and then like rum, you know. And I was like, yeah, I'll have that. And at the end of my trip, you know, I took a picture with the bartender who had been making me all these drinks. And he was on Facebook. I was like, I'll tag you on Facebook. And I just wrote like, best bartender in Tanzania. And then like underneath, like all his friends are like, congratulations, you know, like as if he had won an award, you know, like, like he got like 5 stars from the Michelin or something, you know. And it's just, you know, things like that. I just love, you know, meeting local people. In the Middle East, I was in Kuwait, and I don't know if you know about this, like in each Middle Eastern country, the locals have these kind of like high powered jobs. And then the people cooking and driving the taxis and stuff are often imported from one particular country. Mm-hmm. So in Kuwait, there was a lot of like Bangladeshis. And I speak Bengali, which is people in the east side of India speak that. And so I spoke to all the locals in Bengali, and I'd talk trash about like, you know, like, oh, they're bosses and stuff. And they'd always give me discounts on like if I was trying to buy like a fish or something for, you know, for the collections, or, you know, get a, you know, just funny speaking so much Bengali in this like Middle Eastern country, you know, things like that. Another just funny trip. One last one. We're in the middle of the Amazon, and we're on a boat called Eclipse, which is the same name that Jacques Cousteau's boat was. And it was a party boat. That's why it was called Eclipse. So like the boat had like basically a dance floor and like a strobe light. And in the middle of the Amazon, we just play the loudest dance music like every other night, just to, you know, cause why not? And no one can hear you, you know, like you're in the middle of the river. And I just love remembering flashbacks of things like that, you know, like these tiny moments in the field of just like unexpected joy, you know, once you've survived other things and you know, get to have some fun. That's always really important for me.
It sounds like a lot of, you know, I'm in film and TV, and I travel a lot and do random things. And I sometimes will be in these places, and I'll sit back and I'll be like, this is my job. Like, I'm getting paid to be here right now, right? Like, have you had those moments where you were, you know, specifically to, you know, like, it sounds like you've had the experiential moments like that, but like, what are some of like the science moments where it's a particular species or something like that, where it's like, you're like, holy crap, like this happened today.
Kind of. I mean, I can't believe I get to get paid to do the stuff I get to do. Especially discovering, like, there's some fish I've seen, I'm just like, this is not real, right? Like, I know we just pulled this up, but it was like, this is plastic, or, you know, like, I remember seeing my first, I hope people look this up after, but like, armored sea robin in Taiwan. It's just a big orange fish, and has like, its head looks like like a fake medieval like mask or something, and it's like bright red. I'm like, what is this? There's no way people know about this, because I would have known about it. But you know, it's just like one of those things. When we discovered a new cavefish in Madagascar, like I knew holding it, I was like, there's no black cavefish. Like, this is a new species, you know, like when you can say like, you know, you found something that's new to science, and you know it right away, that's really cool. You know, often locals know about stuff that, you know, a scientist don't know about that are coming in, and whenever I can kind of help spread the knowledge that they have to, you know, to the West or in a scientific way and collaborate with them, I just feel so much joy that like, oh yeah, all right, we're bringing things together, you know, like knowledge from these local places to you know, to the West and getting them involved. I love, you know, I have students from Guatemala and Cuba and traditionally have students from the places I work, and it's just like a joy to be able to have that melding of different countries and their experiences. So yeah, that all that stuff's just like amazing that I get to do that. I think it's so I'm just like shocked that that's a job I get to do.
Well, and it's like, you know, as small as the world feels now with all of the internet and social media and all these things, when you go to these places, it just, you realize how big and diverse it is.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm still hopeful that it stays like that, you know, like, yes, cigars are still better in Cuba, you know, right? Like, scotch is better, you know, in Scotland. You know, there's like things that it's worth traveling for, right? Like, you can't get, and I tell people that who don't travel, and Paul, maybe you have that same experience, right? It's like, no, you don't get it, you know, like, it really is different. Like, they're really, you know, the toilets in Japan have 50 buttons, you know, it's like, you have to go, you know, like, people have different experience, and it feels different. And it's, you're like, you know, you don't get that from watching TV, and you don't get that from watching a travel show. You just have to go there and experience it. And so many people are afraid to travel. And I don't know if, you know, it's the screen times and the amount of screen time that we have, or just, you know, thinking that the internet can populate your needs. But it's, yeah, I really hope people get to travel again and realize in this pandemic year what they've lost. But yeah, you know that, Paul.
My favorite button is the one that makes the noise of the flush. You don't waste water.
And just leave it floating on there.
Yeah. Oh, no, so you're not doing the courtesy flushes.
All right.
You just
make the noise. Oh, I forget. This, I don't think I hit that button. I'll have to go back.
So if, you know, this is always a hard question for people who love their job, but if you weren't in science, if you weren't in research, what do you think you would have done with your life?
Yeah, I go back to, like, I think I got my acceptance to McGill pretty late, and I was going to go to Queens College in New York to be like an English major. Like, I loved my English class senior year in high school, and I was like, oh, maybe I can write like short stories or plays or poetry or something like that. Cause I was just like, maybe that's the way to go. And which is weird, cause it's such a diversion from what I want to be. And it just shows like how easily, even if somebody really loved a particular thing for a long time, like how easily you can go off. But sometimes I still think about like how fun it would be, you know, just being wearing like thick sweaters and, you know, sitting in the cold weather and writing a book or something. And like, I can hardly imagine it now, but some other parallel universe, there's that version of me probably not being interviewed by you. But I don't know. Do you
you're just building up content for those stories later in life.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they'll be true stories though. I don't know. But yeah, right.
Embellish a little.
Yeah, sure.
What do you, I know you're a dad, you have twins. How do you keep yourself busy outside of work?
I love hanging out with them. You know, they're in virtual school right now, so Ontario's still in lockdown, which is safe, but also like super bummer watching everybody else in the US just to have party time already. But
yeah.
But for them, it's been a tough year. So as soon as they're done with virtual school and sit in front of the computer for however many hours, we go out and play. Sometimes we just kick a soccer ball around or ride our bikes, which is nice now because it's also been like minus 600 degrees for 6 months. So it's finally nice to be out. But we love getting out. I love listening to audiobooks. I've been trying to walk 10K a day just to get with, you know, the normalcy of life without, you know, having the contacts that I usually do with other folks.
Yep. How old are your twins?
They are 10 years old, which is crazy. They turned 10 May 9th.
Oh, yeah. I have a 10-year-old. It's nuts. My oldest is 10.
Teenagers.
Yeah, they really are. It's a scary place to be right now. It sounds like just the sabbatical is a good reference to this, but work-life balance in any career, but it, you know, especially in your field, is something that a lot of people have to strive for, it seems. How do you manage work-life balance?
Yeah, I tell people, like, I try to be as smart as possible at work and then as dumb as possible at home. You know, I'm just like my kids think like I'm the dumbest person, you know, just to make them laugh, you know, just to, so I don't get, you know, I don't understand how anything works. I just like try to fool around with them as much as I can. And for me, I think when I give advice for work-life balance, I'm like, you really have to like leave work at home. You know, if you're going to be in front of the kids and hanging out with the kids, you know, an hour of their a full time, you know, you being with them, like eye contact and playing with them is worth like 6 hours if you're just at home next to them on the computer, you know. So, you know, it's really about like concentrating that energy with them when I have time to be with them. And this year's been so weird because what's the difference between work and life? Because you're like, I'm at home in my sweatpants and like, am I working or what? I don't know what's happening right now. You know, like, it's not like I have to go off and go to the office and come back. That was much easier because then it's like, okay, I'm back. You know, now I shut it off. So it's been much harder this pandemic year for sure.
I'm glad we moved to Canada to sit inside.
Yeah. And the other thing is like the weather, you know, like you forget like how, you know, you really do have like 12 months of outdoor time in Louisiana. It can be too hot, but, it's never like, it's so cold, I don't want to, you know, even leave. But you can overdress for it, and that's good. But it's still like, you know, you can die.
Yeah. It's cold. What is what's next for you? It sounds like your sabbatical is ending in a month or so.
Yeah.
What's next for you and the family and your work?
Yeah, I mean, the nice things about these sabbaticals is that you sort of recharge, and I feel recharged. So I'm going to actually take over as a faculty director for this thing called the Center for Collaborative Knowledge. And it's working with some of the humanities profs and connecting the science and humanities. I can connect those two groups, you know, so, you know, a lot of the scientists, you know, they know that we just talk to each other, but we don't learn about, you know, the history of our field or about, you know, things that our colleagues in the humanities are working on. And I just like to see like academia move forward with a more collaborative effort between groups like that. So I'm excited. I'm really excited about that. It's weird. It's a weird thing to do, you know, a collaborative center like that. But I'm really excited about it, you know, put on some events and get people communicating between different parts of LSU and beyond. So, you know, I've had, you know, postdocs who are artists. I've had students that had humanities interests. And I think this is a good way for us to sort of build a more interesting university by having those collaborations between pretty widely divergent groups.
People should be itching to get out and mingle. And
I can't wait.
Mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, and the only way to mingle in academia is like over some sort of beverage, right? And so like we're gonna have a monthly coffees that everybody comes and brings a friend, and you know, pregame drinks before this the other event that we often have. So I don't know. I think that's where collaborations happen.
For sure. A little bigger picture. What do you think are the biggest challenges in science today?
I think for me, it's that science is sort of concentrated in rich Western countries, and there's just so much knowledge and expertise that we haven't tapped into outside. I see it all the time doing field work, you know, where people often helicopter in and they, you know, as soon as they say goodbye, they never think about those people again. And for me, it's like building scientific infrastructure abroad, where, you know, you can go in and really collaborate, like truly collaborate with the folks out there, and understand, you know, why they live in the way they do. And I think people's perceptions of some of the countries I've been to is like, oh, that's a third world country. You know, they make a dollar a day. I'm like, you know, this person eats fish and whatever food they want every day and, you know, has, you know, spends all their time with their family and is living a great life. It's, you know, they don't have an iPod and they don't have, I don't know if anybody has an iPod anymore. I have to update my, like an iPad, you know, like, but they have, you know, they have what they need. And what they don't have maybe is like access to higher ed or to maybe, you know, the kind of healthcare that we have in the West. But other than that, I mean, they're like really content and they know a lot of stuff about the natural world that we just don't understand. And so for me, understanding and building that scientific infrastructure is the biggest gap that we have, right? Like we have to understand people better to make the science work better for everybody.
Yeah, they're probably a lot happier than people who have everything you could ever think you need.
Yeah,
in the picture of things.
Yeah, it's definitely my experience.
What you know, obviously you work with students all the time. What advice do you give to young people who think that science and research and academia are potential career paths?
Yeah, I love hearing it. And I tell them first, you know, it's like when you start in that path, you think failure is not making it to the end goal of becoming a scientist or an academic. But a lot of people leave science and academia and it's not failure. You know, they go on to like other things that they discover. And part of the process is that discovery of the other things that are out there. And, you know, it's sort of a shame that you don't learn about all these other professions earlier, but you know, they you really broaden your horizon just being in academia or going the science route. And so I tell them, you know, don't worry about like, it's not, you don't have to push yourself to do something you don't like, which is a weird advice, right? It's like, I became an academic and a scientist because I really loved it. But I've just also seen other people who've loved the other things that they've learned on the path. And they've gone on to do communication or gone on to work for government. And they love that job too. And, you know, just that enjoy the ride. Like if you're enjoying the ride, then stay with it. If you're not, you might find like a divergent path that you might also enjoy. And so I just tell them to just think broadly. And, you know, I've only had, you know, four or five student PhD students and, except for one who went off to a job that he loved as well. I think I would, you know, all four of them stayed in academia, but I would say that, you know, there's different kinds of success. It's not maybe the things that you understand now, but, you know, give yourself some time to enjoy the ride.
Yeah. Cut yourself some slack a little during the ride. It is. It does sound, it's almost cliche, right? It's like when people are trying to find a career, it's like find something you love or do what you love. You hear it growing up and you hear, you know, people say it all the time, but it's like how big of a thing that is to, you know, it's your entire life. Like you don't, as an 18-year-old, right? You don't really, I feel like, feel that until you're older and you're like, man, if I was doing something that I hated every day,
oh yeah,
how much more miserable would my life be?
I think it was like Jim Carrey who said like his dad got fired from a job and he's like, that's when I learned like you can really you can also, you could do something and get fired from something you hate, you know, and so might as well do something you love and give it your best, you know. But for me, you know, I always tell students like it's a rough road, you know, to get to where you want to go. So that's when you find out like, is it just a passion or is it something you're really willing to grind through? Because it's going to be a grind no matter what you do at some point, right? But now, yeah, at the top of the mountain, that feels, you know, it's easy. Like we were saying before, right? It's like, how do we get to do this every day? It's not fair.